Identifying your center. Where do you stand? What is at the center of your own life? Sometimes that isn't easy to see. Perhaps the best way to identify your own center is to look closely at your life support factors. More often than not, a person's center is some combination of these or other centers. Most people are very much a function of a variety of influences that play upon their lives. Depending on external or internal conditions, one particular center may be activated until the underlying needs are satisfied, and then another center becomes the compelling force. As the person fluctuates from one center to another, the resulting relativism is like roller coasting through life. One moment you're high, the next moment you're low, making efforts to compensate for one weakness by borrowing strength from another weakness. There's no consistent sense of direction, no persistent wisdom, no steady power supply or sense of personal, intrinsic worth and identity. The ideal, of course, is to create one clear center from which you consistently derive a high degree of security, guidance, wisdom, and power, empowering your proactivity and giving congruency and harmony to every part of your life. Let's examine what that center is now. A principle center. By centering our lives on correct principles, universal, timeless, and self-evident, we create a solid foundation for development of the four life support factors. Our security comes from knowing that, unlike other centers based on people or things which are subject to frequent and immediate change, correct principles do not change. We can depend on them. Principles don't react to anything. They don't get mad or treat us differently. They won't divorce us or run away with our best friends. They are not out to get us. They can't pave our way with shortcuts and quick fixes. They don't depend on the behavior of others, the environment, or the current fad for their validity. Principles don't die. They aren't here one day and gone the next. They can't be destroyed by fire, earthquake, or theft. Principles are deep, fundamental truths, classic truths, generic common denominators. They are tightly interwoven threads running with exactness, consistency, beauty, and strength through the fabric of life. Even in the midst of people or circumstances that seem to ignore the principles, we can be secure in the knowledge that principles are bigger than people or circumstances, and that thousands of years of history have seen them triumph time and time again. Even more important, we can be secure in the knowledge that we can validate them in our own lives by our own experience. Admittedly, we're not omniscient. Our knowledge and understanding of correct principles is limited by our own lack of awareness of our own true nature and the world around us, and by the flood of trendy philosophies and theories that are not in harmony with correct principles. These ideas will have their season of acceptance, but like many before them, they won't endure because they're built on false foundations. We are limited, but we can push back the borders of our limitations. An understanding of the principles of our own growth enables us to search out correct principles with the confidence that the more we learn, the more clearly we can focus the lens through which we see the world. The principles don't change. Our understanding of them does. The wisdom and guidance that accompany principle-centered living come from correct maps, from the way things really are, have been, and will be. Correct maps enable us to see clearly where we want to go and how to get there. We can make our decisions using the correct data that will make their implementation possible and meaningful. The personal power that comes from principle-centered living is the power of a self-aware, knowledgeable, proactive individual, unrestricted by the attitudes, behaviors, and actions of others, or by many of the circumstances and environmental influences that limit other people. The only real limitation of power is the natural consequence of the principles themselves. We are free to choose our actions based on our knowledge of correct principles, but we are not free to choose the consequences of those actions. Remember, if you pick up one end of the stick, you pick up the other. Principles always have natural consequences attached to them. There are positive consequences when we live in harmony with the principles. There are negative consequences when we ignore them. But because these principles apply to everyone, whether or not they are aware, this limitation is universal. And the more we know of correct principles, the greater is our personal freedom to act wisely. By centering our lives on timeless and changing principles, we create a fundamental paradigm of effective living. It is the center that puts all other centers in perspective. Remember that your paradigm is the source from which your attitudes and behaviors flow. A paradigm is like a pair of glasses. It affects the way you see everything in your life. If you look at things through the paradigm of correct principles, what you see in life is dramatically different than what you see through any other centered paradigm. But for a quick understanding of the difference your center makes, let's look at just one example of a specific problem as seen through the different paradigms. As you listen, try to put on each pair of glasses. Try to feel the response that flows from the different centers. Suppose tonight you have invited your wife to go to a concert. You have the tickets. She's excited about going. It's 4:00 in the afternoon. All of a sudden, your boss calls you into his office and says he needs your help through the evening to get ready for an important meeting at 9 a.m. tomorrow. If you're looking through spouse-centered or family-centered glasses, your main concern will be your wife. You may tell the boss you can't stay, and you take her to the concert in an effort to please her. You may feel you have to stay to protect your job, but you'll do so grudgingly, anxious about her response, trying to justify your decision and protect yourself from her disappointment or anger. If you're looking through a money-centered lens, your main thought will be of the overtime you'll get or the influence working late may have on a potential raise. You may call your wife and simply tell her you have to stay, assuming she'll understand that economic demands come first. If you're work-centered, you may be thinking of the opportunity. You can learn more about the job. You can make some points with the boss and further your career. You may give yourself a pat on the back for putting in hours well beyond what is required. Evidence of what a hard worker you are. Your wife should be proud of you. If you're possession-centered, you might be thinking of the things the overtime income could buy. Or you might consider what an asset to your reputation at the office it would be if you stayed. Everyone would hear tomorrow how noble, how sacrificing, how dedicated you are. If you're pleasure-centered, you'll probably can the work and go to the concert, even if your wife would be happy for you to work late. You deserve a night out. If you're friend-centered, your decision would be influenced by whether or not you had invited friends to attend the concert with you, or whether your friends at work were going to stay late too. If you're enemy-centered, you may stay late because you know it will give you a big edge over that person in the office who thinks he's the company's greatest asset. While he's off having fun, you'll be working and slaving, doing his work and yours, sacrificing your personal pleasure for the good of the company he can so blithely ignore. If you're church-centered, you might be influenced by plans other church members have to attend the concert, by whether or not any church members work at your office, or by the nature of the concert. Handel's Messiah might rate higher priority than a rock concert. Your decision may also be affected by what you think a good church member would do, and by whether you view the extra work as service or seeking after material wealth. If you're self-centered, you'd be focused on what will do you the most good. Would it be better for you to go out for the evening? Or would it be better for you to make a few points with the boss? How the different options affect you will be your main concern. As we consider various ways of looking at a single event, is it any wonder that we have young lady, old lady perception problems in our interactions with each other? Can you see how fundamentally our centers affect us? Right down to our motivations, our daily decisions, our actions, or in too many cases, our reactions? and all of our interpretations of events? That's why understanding your own center is so important. And if that center does not empower you as a proactive person, it becomes fundamental to your effectiveness to make the necessary paradigm shifts to create a center that will. Now, as a principle-centered person, you try to stand apart from the emotion of the situation and from other factors that would act on you and evaluate the options. Looking at the balanced whole, the work needs, the family needs, other needs that may be involved, and the possible implications of the various alternative decisions, you'll try to come up with the best solution, taking all factors into consideration. Whether you go to the concert or stay and work is really a small part of an effective decision. You might make the same choice with a number of other centers, but there are several important differences when you are coming from a principle-centered paradigm. First, you are not being acted upon by other people or circumstances. You are proactively choosing what you determine to be the best alternative. You make your decision consciously and knowledgeably. Second, you know your decision is most effective because it is based on principles with predictable long-term results. Third, what you choose to do contributes to your ultimate values in life. Staying at work to get the edge on someone at the office is an entirely different evening in your life from staying because you value your boss's effectiveness and you genuinely want to contribute to the company's welfare. The experiences you have as you carry out your decision takes on quality and meaning in the context of your life as a whole. Fourth, you can communicate to your wife and your boss within the strong networks you've created in your interdependent relationships. Because you are independent, you can be effectively interdependent. You might decide to delegate what is delegatable and come in early the next morning to do the rest. And finally, you'll feel comfortable about your decision. Whatever you choose to do, you can focus on it and enjoy it. As a principle-centered person, you see things differently. And because you see things differently, you think differently, you act differently. Because you have a high degree of security, guidance, wisdom, and power that flows from a solid, unchanging core, you have the foundation of a highly proactive and highly effective life. Writing and using a personal mission statement. As we go deeply within ourselves, as we understand and realign our basic paradigms to bring them in harmony with correct principles, we create both an effective, empowering center and a clear lens through which we can see the world. We can then focus that lens on how we, as unique individuals, relate to that world. Frankl says we detect rather than invent our missions in life. I like that choice of words. I think each of us has an internal monitor or sense, a conscience, that gives us an awareness of our own uniqueness and the singular contributions that we can make. In Frankl's words, everyone has his own specific vocation or mission in life. Therein he cannot be replaced, nor can his life be repeated. Thus, everyone's task is as unique as is his specific opportunity to implement it. Close quote. In seeking to give verbal expression to that uniqueness, we are again reminded of the fundamental importance of proactivity and of working within our circle of influence. To seek some abstract meaning in our lives out in our circle of concern is to abdicate our proactive responsibility, to place our own first creation in the hands of circumstance and of other people. Our meaning comes from within. Again, in the words of Frankl, ultimately, man should not ask what the meaning of his life is, but rather must recognize that it is he who is asked. In a word, each man is questioned by life, and he can only answer to life by answering for his own life. To life, he can only respond by being responsible. Close quote. Personal responsibility or proactivity is fundamental to the first creation. Returning to the computer metaphor, habit one says, you are the programmer. Habit two then says, write the program. Until you accept the idea that you are responsible, that you are the programmer, you won't really invest in writing the program. As proactive people, we can begin to give expression to what we want to be and to do in our lives. We can write a personal mission statement, a personal constitution. A mission statement is not something you write overnight. It takes deep introspection, careful analysis, thoughtful expression, and often many rewrites to produce it in final form. It may take you several weeks or even months before you really feel comfortable with it, before you feel it is complete and concise, a full expression of your innermost values and directions. Even then, you will want to renew it regularly and make minor, sometimes even major changes as the years bring additional insights or changing circumstances. But fundamentally, your mission statement becomes your constitution, the solid expression of your vision and values. It becomes the criterion by which you measure everything else in your life. I recently finished reviewing my own mission statement, which I do fairly regularly. Sitting on the edge of a beach alone at the end of a bicycle ride, I took out my organizer and hammered it out. It took several hours, but I felt a sense of clarity, a sense of organization and commitment, and a sense of exhilaration and freedom. I find the process is as important as the product. Writing or reviewing a mission statement changes you because it forces you to think through your priorities deeply, carefully, and to align your behavior with your beliefs. Furthermore, writing is a psychoneuromuscular activity that imprints the subconscious mind, as does visualizing. As you go through these processes, other people begin to sense that you are not being driven by everything that happens to you. You have a sense of mission about what you're trying to do, and you are genuinely excited about it. Using your whole brain. Our self-awareness empowers us to examine our own thoughts. This is particularly helpful in creating a personal mission statement because the two unique human endowments that enable us to practice habit two, that is, imagination and conscience, are primarily functions of the right side of the brain. Understanding how to tap into that right brain capacity greatly increases our first creation ability. A great deal of research has been conducted for decades on what has come to be called brain dominance theory. The findings basically indicate that each hemisphere of the brain, left and right, tends to specialize in and preside over different functions, process different kinds of information, and deal with different kinds of problems. Essentially, the left hemisphere is the more logical, verbal one, and the right hemisphere the more intuitive, creative one. The left deals with words, the right with pictures. The left with parts and specifics. The right with wholes and the relationships between the parts. The left deals with analysis, which means to break apart. The right deals with synthesis, which means to put together. The left deals with sequential thinking. The right with simultaneous and holistic thinking. The left is time-bound. The right is time-free. Although people use both sides of the brain, one side or the other generally tends to be dominant in each individual. Of course, the idea would be to cultivate and develop the ability to have good crossover between both sides of the brain so that a person could first sense what the situation called for and then use the appropriate tool to deal with it. But people tend to stay in the comfort zone of their dominant hemisphere and process every situation according to either a left or a right brain preference. In the words of Abraham Maslow, he that is good with a hammer tends to think everything is a nail. This is another factor that affects the old lady, young lady perception difference. Right brain and left brain people tend to look at things in different ways. We live in a primarily left-brain-dominant world, where words and measurement and logic are enthroned, and the more creative, intuitive, sensing, artistic aspect of our nature is often subordinated. Many of us find it more difficult to tap into our right-brain capacity. Admittedly, this description is oversimplified and new studies will undoubtedly throw more light on brain functioning. But the point here is that we are capable of performing many different kinds of thought processes, and we barely tap our potential. As we become aware of its different capacities, we can consciously use our minds to meet specific needs in more effective ways. Two ways to tap the right brain. If we use the brain dominance theory as a model, it becomes evident that the quality of our first creation is significantly impacted by our ability to use our creative right brain. The more we are able to draw upon our right brain capacity, the more fully we will be able to visualize, to synthesize, to transcend time and present circumstances, to project a holistic picture of what we want to do and to be in life. Expand perspective. Sometimes we are knocked out of our left brain environment and thought patterns and into the right brain by an unplanned experience. The death of a loved one, a severe illness, a financial setback, or extreme adversity can cause us to stand back, look at our lives, and ask ourselves some hard questions. What's really important? Why am I doing what I'm doing? But if you're proactive, you don't have to wait for circumstances or other people to create perspective-expanding experiences. You can consciously create your own. There are a number of ways to do this. Through the powers of your imagination, you can visualize your own funeral, as we did at the beginning of this chapter. You can write your own eulogy. Actually write it out. Be specific. You can visualize your 25th and then your 50th wedding anniversary. Have your spouse visualize this with you. Try to capture the essence of the family relationship you want to have created through your day-to-day investment over a period of that many years. You can visualize your retirement from your present occupation. What contributions, what achievements will you want to have made in your field? What plans do you have after your retirement? Will you enter a second career? Expand your mind. Visualize in rich detail. Involve as many emotions and feelings as possible. Involve as many of the senses as you can. I have done similar visualization exercises with some of my university classes. I've said, assume you have only one semester to live, and that during that semester, you are to stay in school as a good student. Visualize how you would spend your semester. Things are suddenly placed in a different perspective. Values quickly surface that before weren't even recognized. I have also asked students to live with that expanded perspective for a week and keep a diary of their experiences. The results are very revealing. They start writing to parents to tell them how much they love and appreciate them. They reconcile with a brother, a sister, a friend where the relationship has deteriorated. The dominant central theme of their activities, the underlying principle, is almost always love. The futility of bad-mouthing, bad thinking, put-downs, and accusation become very evident when they think in terms of having only a short time to live. Principles and values become more evident to everybody. There are a number of techniques using your imagination that can put you in touch with your values. The net effect of every one I've ever used is the same. When people seriously undertake to identify what really matters most to them in their lives, what they really want to be and to do, they become very reverent. They start to think in terms that are larger than today and tomorrow. Visualization and affirmation. Personal leadership is not a singular experience. It doesn't begin and end with the writing of a personal mission statement. It is rather the ongoing process of keeping your vision and values before you and aligning your life to be congruent with those most important things. And in that effort, your powerful right brain capacity can be a great help to you on a daily basis as you work to integrate your personal mission statement into your life. It's another application of begin with the end in mind. Let's go back to an example we mentioned before. Suppose I am a parent who really deeply loves my children. Suppose I identify that as one of my fundamental values in my personal mission statement. But suppose on a daily basis, I have trouble overreacting. You see, I can use my right brain power of visualization to write an affirmation that will help me become more congruent with my deeper values in my daily life. A good affirmation has five basic ingredients. It's personal, it's positive, it's present tense, it's visual, and it's emotional. So I might write something like this. It is deeply satisfying, that is emotional, that I, personal, respond, present tense, with wisdom, love, firmness, and self-control, positive, when my children misbehave. Then I can visualize it. I can spend a few minutes each day and totally relax my mind and body. I can think about situations in which my children might misbehave. I can visualize them in rich detail. I can feel the texture of the chair I might be sitting on, the floor under my feet, the sweater I'm wearing. I can see the dress my daughter has on, the expression on her face. The more clearly and vividly I can imagine the detail, the more deeply I will experience it, the less I will see it as a spectator. Then I can see her do something very specific which normally makes my heart pound and my temper start to flare. But instead of seeing my normal response, I see myself handle that situation with all of the love, the power, the self-control I have captured in my affirmation. I can write the program, write the script, in harmony with my values, with my personal mission statement. And if I do this, day after day, my behavior will change. Instead of living out of the scripts given to me by my own parents, or by society, or by genetics, or my environment, I will be living out of the script I have written from my own self-selected value system. I have helped and encouraged my son Sean to use this affirmation process extensively throughout his football career. We started when he played quarterback in high school, and eventually I taught him how to do it on his own. We would try to get him into a very relaxed state of mind through deep breathing and a progressive muscle relaxation technique so that he would become very quiet inside. Then I would help him visualize himself right in the heat of the toughest situations imaginable. He would imagine a big blitz coming at him fast. He had to read the blitz and respond. He would imagine giving audibles at the line after reading defenses. He would imagine quick reads with his first receiver, his second receiver, his third receiver. He would imagine options that he normally wouldn't do. At one point in his football career, he told me he was constantly getting uptight. As we talked, I realized that he was visualizing uptightness. So we worked on visualizing relaxation in the middle of the big pressure circumstance. We discovered that the nature of the visualization is very important. If you visualize the wrong thing, you'll produce the wrong thing. Dr. Charles Garfield has done extensive research on peak performers, both in athletics and in business. He became fascinated with peak performance in his work with the NASA program. Watching the astronauts rehearse everything on Earth again and again in a simulated environment before they went into space. Although he had a doctorate in mathematics, he decided to go back and get another PhD in the field of psychology and study the characteristics of peak performers. One of the main things his research showed was that almost all of the world-class athletes and other peak performers are visualizers. They see it. They feel it. They experience it before they actually do it. They begin with the end in mind. You can do it in every area of your life. Before a performance, a sales presentation, a difficult confrontation, or a daily challenge of meeting a goal, see it clearly, vividly, relentlessly, over and over again. Create an internal comfort zone. Then when you get into the situation, it isn't foreign. It doesn't scare you. You are in your comfort zone. Your creative visual right brain is one of your most important assets, both in creating your personal mission statement and in integrating it into your life. There is an entire body of literature and audio and videotapes that deal with this process of visualization and affirmation. Some of the more recent developments in this field include such things as subliminal programming, neuro-linguistic programming, and new forms of relaxation and self-talk processes. These all involve explanation, elaboration, and different packaging of the fundamental principles of the first creation. My review of the success literature brought me in contact with hundreds of books on this subject. Although some made extravagant claims and relied on anecdotal rather than scientific evidence, I think that most of the material is fundamentally sound. The majority of it appears to have originally come out of the study of the Bible by many individuals. In effective personal leadership, visualization and affirmation techniques emerge naturally out of a foundation of well-thought-through purposes and principles that become the center of a person's life. They are extremely powerful in re-scripting and reprogramming into writing deeply committed to purposes and principles into one's heart and mind. I believe that central to all enduring religions in society are the same principles and practices clothed in different language: meditation, prayer, covenants, ordinances, scripture study, empathy, compassion, and many different forms of the use of both conscience and imagination. But if these techniques become part of the personality ethic and are severed from a base of character and principles, they can be misused and abused in serving other centers, primarily the center of self. Affirmation and visualization are forms of programming, and we must be certain that we do not submit ourselves to any programming that is not in harmony with our basic center, or that comes from sources centered on money-making, self-interest, or anything other than correct principles. The imagination can be used to achieve the fleeting success that comes when a person is focused on material gain or on what's in it for me. But I believe the higher use of imagination is in harmony with the use of conscience to transcend self and create a life of contribution based on unique purpose and on the principles that govern interdependent reality. Identifying roles and goals. Of course, the logical verbal left brain becomes important also as you attempt to capture the right brain images, feelings, and pictures in the words of a written mission statement. Just as breathing exercises help integrate body and mind, writing is a kind of psychoneuromuscular activity which helps bridge and integrate the conscious and subconscious minds. Writing distills, crystallizes, and clarifies thought and helps break the whole into parts. We each have a number of different roles in our lives, different areas or capacities in which we have responsibility. I may, for example, have a role as an individual, a husband, a father, a teacher, a church member, and a businessman. And each of these roles is important. One of the major problems that arises when people work to become more effective in life is that they don't think broadly enough. They lose a sense of proportion, the balance, the natural ecology necessary to effective living. They may get consumed by work and neglect personal health. In the name of professional success, they may neglect the most precious relationships in their lives. You may find that your mission statement will be much more balanced, much easier to work with, if you break it down into the specific role areas of your life and the goals you want to accomplish in each area. For instance, look at your professional role. You might be a salesperson or a manager or a product developer. What are you about in that area? What are the values that should guide you? Now think of your personal roles: husband, wife, father, mother, neighbor, friend. What are you about in those roles? What's important to you? Now think of your community roles, the political area, public service, volunteer organizations. One executive has used the idea of roles and goals to create the following mission statement. My mission is to live with integrity and to make a difference in the lives of others. To fulfill this mission, I have charity. I seek out and love the one, each one, regardless of his situation. I sacrifice. I devote my time, talents, and resources to my mission. I inspire. I teach by example that we are the children of a loving Heavenly Father and that every Goliath can be overcome. I am impactful. What I do makes difference in the lives of others. These roles take priority in achieving my mission. Husband, my partner is the most important person in my life. Together we contribute the fruits of harmony, industry, charity, and thrift. Father, I help my children experience progressively greater joy in their lives. Son or brother, I am frequently there for support and love. Christian, God can count on me to keep my covenants and to serve His other children. Neighbor, the love of Christ is visible through my actions toward others. Change agent, I am a catalyst for developing high performance in large organizations. Scholar, I learn important new things every day. Writing your mission in terms of the important roles in your life gives you balance and harmony. It keeps each role clearly before you. You can review your roles frequently to make sure that you don't get totally absorbed by one role to the exclusion of others that are equal or even more important in your life. After you identify your various roles, then you can think about the long-term goals you want to accomplish in each of those roles. We're into the right brain again, using imagination, creativity, conscience, and inspiration. If these goals are an extension of a mission statement based on correct principles, they will be vitally different from the goals that people normally set. They will be in harmony with correct principles, with natural laws, which gives you greater power to achieve them. They are not someone else's goals you have absorbed. They are your goals. They reflect your deepest values, your unique talent, your sense of mission, and they grow out of your chosen roles in life. An effective goal focuses primarily on results rather than activity. It identifies where you want to be, and in the process helps you determine where you are. It gives you important information on how to get there, and it tells you when you have arrived. It unifies your efforts and energy. It gives meaning and purpose to all you do. And it can finally translate itself in the daily activities so that you are proactive, you are in charge of your life, you are making happen each day the things that will enable you to fulfill your personal mission statement. Roles and goals give structure and organized direction to your personal mission. If you don't yet have a personal mission statement, it's a good place to begin. Just identifying the various areas of your life and the two or three important results you feel you should accomplish in each area to move ahead gives you an overall perspective of your life and a sense of direction. As we move into Habit 3, we'll go into greater depth in the area of short-term goals. The important application at this point is to identify roles and long-term goals as they relate to your personal mission statement. These roles and goals will provide the foundation for effective goal setting and achieving when we get to the Habit 3, day-to-day management of life and time. Family mission statements. Because Habit 2 is based on principle, it has broad application. In addition to individuals, families, service groups, and organizations of all kinds become significantly more effective as they begin with the end in mind. Many families are managed on the basis of crises, moods, quick fixes, and instant gratification, not on sound principles. Symptoms surface whenever stress and pressure mount. People become cynical, critical, or silent, or they start yelling and overreacting. Children who observe these kinds of behavior grow up thinking the only way to solve problems is fight or flight. That's what animals do. The core of any family is what is changeless, what is always going to be there, your shared vision and values. By writing a family mission statement, you give expression to its true foundation. The mission statement becomes its constitution, the standard, the criterion for evaluation and decision-making. It gives continuity and unity to the family as well as direction. When individual values are harmonized with those of the family, members work together for common purposes that are deeply felt. Again, remember, the process is as important as the product. The very process of writing and refining a mission statement becomes a key way to improve the family, particularly when the entire family is involved in producing it. Working together to create a family mission statement builds the PC capacity to live it. By getting input from every family member, drafting a statement, getting feedback, revising it, and using wording from different family members, you get the family talking, communicating on things that really matter deeply. The best mission statements are the result of family members coming together in a spirit of mutual respect, expressing their different views, and working together to create something greater than any one individual could do alone. Periodic review to expand perspective, shift emphasis or direction, amend or give new meaning to time-worn phrases can keep the family united in common values and purposes. The mission statement becomes the framework for thinking, for governing the family. When the problems and crises come, which are inevitable, the Constitution is there to remind family members of the things that matter most, and to provide direction for problem-solving and decision-making based on correct principles. In our home, we put our family mission statement up on a wall in the family room so that we can look at it and monitor ourselves daily. When we read the phrases about the sounds of love in our home, about order, responsible independence, cooperation, helpfulness, meeting needs, developing talents, showing interest in each other's talents, and giving service to others, it gives us some criteria to know how we're doing in the things that matter most to us as a family. When we plan our family goals and activities, we say, in light of these principles, what are the goals we're going to work on? What are our action plans to accomplish our goals and actualize these values? We review the statements frequently and rework goals and jobs twice a year, in September and June, the beginning of school and the end of school, to reflect the situation as it is, to improve it, to strengthen it. It renews us. It recommits us to what we believe in, what we stand for. Organizational mission statements. Mission statements are also vital to successful organizations. One of the most important thrusts of my work with organizations is to assist them in developing effective mission statements. And to be effective, that statement has to come from within the bowels of the organization, top down and bottom up. Everyone should participate in a meaningful way, not just the top strategy planners, but everyone. Once again, the involvement process is as important as the written product and is the key to its continual use. I am always intrigued whenever I go to IBM and watch the training process there. Time and time again, I see the leadership of the organization come into a group and say that IBM stands for three things: the dignity of the individual, excellence, and service. These things represent the belief system of IBM. Everything else will change, but these three things will not change. Almost like osmosis, this belief system has spread throughout the entire organization, providing a tremendous base of shared values and personal security for everyone who works there. Once I was training a group of people for IBM in New York. It was a small group, about 20 people, and one of them became ill. He called his wife in California, who expressed concern because his illness required special treatment. The IBM people responsible for the training session arranged to have him taken to an excellent hospital with medical specialists in the disease. but they could sense that his wife was uncertain and really wanted him home, where their personal physician could handle the problem. So they decided to get him home. Concerned about the time involved in driving him to the airport and waiting for a commercial plane, they brought in a helicopter, flew him to the airport, and hired a special plane just to take this man to California. I don't know what cost that involved. My guess would be many thousands of dollars. But IBM believed in the dignity of the individual. That's what the company stands for. To those present, that experience represented its belief system and was no surprise. I was impressed. At another time, I was scheduled to train 175 shopping center managers at a particular hotel. I was amazed at the level of service there. It wasn't a cosmetic thing. It was evident at all levels, spontaneously, without supervision. I arrived quite late, checked in, and asked if room service was available. The man at the desk said, "No, Mr. Covey, but if you're interested, I could go back and get a sandwich or a salad or whatever you'd like that we have in the kitchen." His attitude was one of total concern about my comfort and welfare. "Would you like to see your convention room?" he continued. "Do you have everything you need? What can I do for you? I'm here to serve you." There was no supervisor there checking up. This man was sincere. The next day, I was in the middle of a presentation when I discovered that I didn't have all of the colored markers I needed. I went out into the hall during a brief break and found a bellboy running to another convention. "I've got a problem," I said. "I'm here training a group of managers, and I only have a short break. I need some more colored pens." He whipped around and almost came to attention. He glanced at my name tag and said, "Mr. Covey, I will solve your problem." He didn't say, "I don't know where to go," or, "Well, go and check at the front desk." He just took care of it. And he made me feel like it was his privilege to do so. Later, I was in a side lobby looking at some of the art objects. Someone from the hotel came up to me and said, "Mr. Covey, would you like to see a book that describes the art objects in this hotel?" How anticipatory. How service-oriented. I next observed one of the employees high up on a ladder, cleaning windows in the lobby. From his vantage point, he saw a woman having a little difficulty in the garden with a walker. She hadn't really fallen, and she was with other people. But he climbed down that ladder, went outside, helped the woman into the lobby, and saw that she was properly taken care of. Then he went back and finished cleaning the windows. I wanted to find out how this organization had created a culture where people bought so deeply into the value of customer service. I interviewed housekeepers, waitresses, bellboys in that hotel and found that this attitude had impregnated the hearts, minds, and attitudes of every employee there. I went through the back door into the kitchen where I saw the central value: uncompromising, personalized service. I finally went to the manager and said, "My business is helping organizations develop a powerful team character, a team culture. I'm amazed at what you have here." "Do you want to know the real key?" he inquired. He pulled out the mission statement for the hotel chain. After reading it, I acknowledged, "That's an impressive statement. But I know many companies that have impressive mission statements." "Do you want to see the one for this hotel?" he asked. "Do you mean you developed one just for this hotel?" "Yes." "Different from the one for the hotel chain?" "Yes." "It's in harmony with that statement, but this one pertains to our situation, our environment, our time." He handed me another paper. "Who developed this mission statement?" I asked. "Everybody," he replied. "Everybody? I mean, really everybody?" "Yes." "Housekeepers?" "Yes." "Waitresses?" "Yes." "Desk clerks?" "Yes." "Do you want to see the mission statement written by the people who greeted you last night?" He pulled out a mission statement that they themselves had written that was interwoven with all of the other mission statements. Everyone at every level was involved. The mission statement for that hotel was the hub of a great wheel. It spawned the thoughtful, more specialized mission statements of particular groups of employees. It was used as a criterion for every decision that was made. It clarified what those people stood for, how they related to the customer, how they related to each other. It affected the style of the managers and the leaders. It affected the compensation system. It affected the kind of people they recruited and how they trained and developed them. Every aspect of that organization, essentially, was a function of that hub, that mission statement. I later visited another hotel in the same chain, and the first thing I did when I checked in was to ask to see their mission statement, which they promptly gave me. At this hotel, I came to understand the motto, Uncompromising Personalized Service, a little more. For a 3-day period, I watched every conceivable situation where service was called for. I always found that service was delivered in a very impressive, excellent way. But it was always also very personalized. For instance, in the swimming area, I asked the attendant where the drinking fountain was. He walked me to it. But the thing that impressed me the very most was to see an employee on his own admit a mistake to his boss. We ordered room service and were told when it would be delivered to the room. On the way to our room, the room service person spilled the hot chocolate, and it took a few extra minutes to go back and change the linen on the tray and replace the drink. So the room service was about 15 minutes late, which was really not that important to us. Nevertheless, the next morning, the room service manager phoned us to apologize and invited us to have either the buffet breakfast or a room service breakfast compliments of the hotel to in some way compensate for the inconvenience. What does it say about the culture of an organization when an employee admits his mistake, unknown to anyone else, to the manager so that the customer or guest is better taken care of? As I told the manager of the first hotel I visited, I know a lot of companies with impressive mission statements, but there is a real difference, all of the difference in the world, in the effectiveness of a mission statement created by everyone involved in an organization and one written by a few top executives behind a mahogany wall. One of the fundamental problems in organizations, including families, is that people are not committed to the determinations of other people for their lives. They simply don't buy into them. Many times as I work with organizations, I find people whose goals are totally different from the goals of the enterprise. I commonly find reward systems completely out of alignment with shared value systems. When I begin work with companies that have already developed some kind of mission statement, I ask them, how many of the people here know that you have a mission statement? How many of you know what it contains? How many were involved in creating it? How many really buy into it and use it as your frame of reference in making decisions? Without involvement, there is no commitment. Mark it down, asterisk it, circle it, underline it. No involvement, no commitment. Now, in the early stages, when a person is new to an organization or when a child in the family is young, you can pretty well give them a goal and they'll buy it, particularly if the relationship, the orientation, and the training are good. But as people become more mature and their lives take on a separate meaning, they want involvement, significant involvement. And if they don't have that involvement, they don't buy it. Then you have a significant motivational problem, which cannot be solved at the same level of thinking that created it. That's why creating an organizational mission statement takes time, patience, involvement, skill, and empathy. Again, it's not a quick fix. It takes time and sincerity, correct principles, and the courage and integrity to align systems, structure, and management style to the shared vision and values. But it's based on correct principles, and it works. An organizational mission statement, one that truly reflects the deeply shared visions and values of everyone within that organization, creates a great unity and a tremendous commitment. It creates in people's hearts and minds a frame of reference, a set of criteria or guidelines by which they will govern themselves. They don't need someone else directing, controlling, criticizing, or taking cheap shots. They have bought into the changeless core of what the organization is all about. Here are a few application suggestions in applying Habit 2, Begin with the End in Mind. 1. Take the time to record the impressions you had in the funeral visualization at the beginning of this chapter. Remember to focus on those four areas of activity: family, friends, work, community service, and so forth, and look at three basic aspects: character, contributions, and achievements. 2, take a few moments and write down your roles as you now see them. Are you satisfied with that mirror image of your life? 3, set up time to completely separate yourself from daily activities and to begin to work on your personal mission statement. 4, think through very carefully the different centers of a person's life and see what you have come to find your center to be. 5, start a collection of notes, quotes, and ideas you may want to use as resource material in writing your personal mission statement. 6, identify a project you will be facing in the near future and apply the principle of mental creation. Write down the results you desire and what steps will lead to those results. 7, share the principles of Habit 2 with your family or work group and suggest that together you begin the process of developing a family or a group mission statement.